Come on, let's get going now.
From KMOX Sports.
We're primed and ready.
All day, baby.
Man, let's go.
This is the Graybar Sports Open Live. Graybar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs on 104.1 FM, KMOX.
Graybar Sports Open Line on this Thursday evening. Nate Gatter with you in for Matt Pauly. He will be back tomorrow when the Cardinals resume the second half in Arizona against the Diamondbacks. A three-game series, start of a six-game road trip. They'll be back home for their first game at Busch Stadium post-All-Star break a week from tonight. Sonny Gray would be scheduled to start that game against the San Diego Padres. We'll be talking about the Cardinals setting their rotation, some Cardinals news out of the draft. We'll be wrapping up our MLB draft conversations with Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline in about 10 minutes. Ben Hochman of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch will be with us after that to talk Cardinals, and we'll wrap up the first hour with more of the Redbirds. In the second hour, we'll visit again with Dan Reardon, KMOX golf correspondent who was with us last night to preview the Open Championship. The first round was played this morning, St. Louis time, wrapped up in the early afternoon hours, and he will recap the first round, look ahead to the second, coming up from Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland. Those tee times, again, will be just after midnight. The first round of groups will go out just after midnight St. Louis time here locally. And then in the later part of the show, we're going to talk some Missouri football. The Tigers will be in action, 6 weeks from tonight? Is that right? 5 weeks from tonight? The 28th of August. I think it'll be 6 weeks from tonight. I'll have to double check that. That they will open up the season. They were at SEC Media Days today. This morning was Mizzou's slot in the SEC Media Days. Head coach Eli Drinkwitz was at the podium taking questions. He was his usual colorful self. We will chat with Zach Sweet, Mizzou football beat writer for the Columbia Missourian, about Drinkwitz's comments this morning. The quarterback situation headlined by Penn State transfer Bo Prabula, who Missouri reportedly paid $1.5 million in NIL money to transfer in. And he has no real college experience. He has been on the field at Penn State, but he has never been the starting quarterback anywhere. And so his opportunities at Penn State were relatively limited. Where he was on the field in more impactful games, it was often in mop-up duties or in specific packages, maybe as a runner. So that's a lot of money for a guy who is at least unproven at the top levels of college football. They also added Ahmad Hardy at running back out of Louisiana Monroe. He is picked by some to be first or second team All-SEC at running back this year, even though he was coming from one of the smallest schools in the FBS. He was a very coveted transfer, and Missouri landed Hardy. So we'll talk about that, as well as position groups where the most remains up for grabs. Should mention with the quarterback situation, and this will come up in that conversation with Zach, I'm sure. Not only is there just the intrigue around Bo Prabula and what is Missouri really getting with him, there's also some intrigue around Sam Horn, who was at one time this celebrated recruit out of Georgia who Missouri signed a four-star several years ago, who was going to play both football and baseball. He has been on the field sparingly in football and not a whole lot as a pitcher in baseball because he's had injuries in both sports. He is recovering or recently recovered from Tommy John surgery. The Tigers, at last update, were expecting to have him at least healthy-ish here for fall camp and available. Eli Drinkwitz this morning said they're still expecting him to be in the fold this fall as, at minimum, a more experienced backup ahead of top high school recruit Matt Zollers, who is also on the roster now. Obviously, Missouri would rather not have Zollers as the primary backup just to feel they have a little more security behind Prabula if they were to need it, kind of along the lines of why they had Drew Pine on the team last year backing up Brady Cook, although Drew Pine really was not good with the exception of like 5 minutes at the end of the Oklahoma game when all of a sudden he found his form. So we'll talk about all of those things. Sam Horn was drafted, by the way, by the Los Angeles Dodgers in the 18th round on Monday night. In the MLB draft, the expectation is that he will not sign, though, in the 2 weeks that the Dodgers have to try to get him signed to a contract. And clearly, MLB teams had heard that from Horn's agent because he was considered a top 150, top 125 type prospect for the draft and obviously went well beyond that all the way down to the 18th round. So that is an indicator that teams don't necessarily expect him to sign. The Cardinals update, you might have heard it during Redbird Rush Hour with Kevin Wheeler. The Cardinals have set the rotation for Arizona over the weekend, starting tomorrow. Andre Pallante will pitch Friday, then Sonny Gray Saturday, and Miles Michaelis Sunday. That would set up for Matthew Liberatore, Eric Fetty, and then Pallante again as the likely trio in Colorado when the Cardinals wrap up the road trip, and then Sonny Gray to start the first game of the homestand a week from tonight against San Diego. Cardinals draft news. The Redbirds signed first-round pick Liam Doyle for a reported signing bonus of $7.25 million, the highest draft bonus in the history of the club. Second-round pick Ryan Mitchell, a high schooler, said in an interview with a TV station in his native Memphis that he and the Cardinals agreed to a bonus of more than $1 million to entice him to forego his commitment to Georgia Tech and instead turn pro. Doyle's deal comes in nearly $1 million under the expected slot value of the number five pick, which called for about $8.1 million bonus. Mitchell's slot value at number 55 pegged at 1.7-ish million. So we don't know his exact number yet, but it seems likely he'll be at least slightly under slot as well. We'll talk to Sam Dykstra about a little bit of what that means when a player signs for under slot value. Those slot values are not binding, but they open up a little bit of flexibility because teams have a limit on how much money they can hand out overall in a bonus pool in a particular draft class. So potentially they can sign some guys they took later on in those first 10 rounds for overslot bonuses, or even sprinkle in bonuses to guys in the latter 10 rounds in the back half of the draft that don't have slot values attached to their selections at all. If you want to get in on the conversations, you can type a comment wherever you're watching on our streams. That would be Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. You can just type your comment right there. You can also call us 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. You can tweet us at KMOX Sports. Daniel Hinkamp, my producer, is standing by to keep an eye on any tweets that come in and to answer your calls. We appreciate you being with us on any of the streams on 104.1 FM or elsewhere, including on the free Odyssey app, where you can also get a comment in by tapping the microphone icon to leave a talkback message that we can play on the air. So we'll be talking MLB draft and Cardinals coming up. Sam Dykstra, then Benjamin Hockman, golf and Mizzou football in the second half of the show. Should be a lot of fun just getting going. Gray Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Gray Bar Sports Open Line continues. Nate Gatter with you in for Matt Pauly. He'll be back tomorrow when the Cardinals open the second half against the Arizona Diamondbacks. Before we dig in too much to what's to come for the Cardinals at the Major League level, we are going to talk a little bit more about the Major League draft from Sunday and Monday. We welcome in Sam Dykstra from MLB Pipeline. Sam, how you doing?
Good. How are you guys doing?
We are doing great. We appreciate you making the time for us. You can follow Sam on Twitter at Sam Dykstra, MILB. Sam, the Cardinals pretty much got what they wanted with Liam Doyle at the number five pick. The consensus seems to be that it was going to be, in their perfect world, either Doyle or maybe Willits at that spot. Willits went number one to Washington. Then Tyler Bremner going number two, pretty much assured that Doyle would be there for number five. You feel like that's probably how the calculus went for St. Louis?
Yeah, I mean, some of the names we heard tied to the Cardinals a lot were Eli Willits, Liam Doyle, even Jojo Parker, who ended up going eight to the Blue Jays. Once the Angels had maybe the most shocking pick of the first round by taking Tyler Bremner out of UC Santa Barbara, that opened up a lot of avenues to the Cardinals, and then they basically had their pick. I mean, Willits going one took him off the board, but they still had a lot of good options there. And by taking Doyle, they may have gotten the most electric pitcher in this entire class.
He signed for $7.25 million, which is a franchise record signing bonus because obviously the bonuses go up and the Cardinals rarely pick in the top five, but it's still almost $900,000 under the $8.13 million that is the sort of recommended slot value of the number five pick. For people who are maybe newer to the MLB draft or who are only interested because the Cardinals did in fact pick in the top five this year, can you explain kind of the significance of the slot values and then in particular the significance of the Cardinals saving, let's say, $880,000 or so by signing Doyle to a below slot bonus?
Yeah, so for rounds 1 through 10, each pick is assigned a certain slot bonus. So in Liam Doyle's case, it was around $8.13 million. He signs for $7.25. You add up all those totals and you get what is called your bonus pool. So the Cardinals had a bonus pool that was $14.2 million. That's how much you have to spend on all of your draft picks. Now, picks 11 through 20 in rounds 11 through 20, I should say, have a cap of 150,000. So you can sign anybody in those rounds for 150,000. Doesn't count towards your pool. If you go above that, then you're starting to eat into your pool a little bit. So that $880,000 that you're talking about is savings that they can spread around to the rest of their class. Now, they went pretty college heavy. But when you take Ryan Mitchell in the second round, a outfielder out of a Tennessee high school, you know, he has some leverage. He could go to school. And now that's $900,000 you could use to go above his bonus slot, which is $1.72 million, talk him out of going to school and signing with St. Louis. And when you get guys to take a haircut, you get more good players. It makes your class better. It makes your farm system better.
One of the things we've seen the Cardinals do in the past, and they're not unique in this regard, especially if they're going with a college-heavy class the way they did this year, literally taking just the one high school kid, Ryan Mitchell, with the second-round pick, is that then maybe in rounds 18, 19, 20, you'd see a selection kind of like the Dodgers took Sam Horn, who we were talking about in the last segment, Mizzou pitcher slash quarterback, knowing that he's unlikely to sign, just to see if they could figure something out, because that's a guy who would be top three-round talent, let's say, on paper, but the signability concerns push him down. Are you surprised at all if the Cardinals had an inkling that they might be able to save money on Doyle and potentially some of these other college guys who they took toward the top of the draft, that they didn't mix in a couple of difficult signability guys late on and see if throwing $500,000 at one of them would make a difference?
I mean, maybe a little bit. I mean, they did get Jalen Flores in the 11th round, who was somebody we had at MLB Pipeline ranked as the 235th best overall prospect. They got him at pick 330. So that's some money that he's probably going to want if they're going to sign him away from Texas. But you look at the rest of the class, I mean, guys like Jack Gurevich, he's a draft-eligible sophomore. He did very easily just go back to University of San Diego. They didn't take a lot of senior guys. And seniors are where you really get those deals. You'll get guys signed for $10,000 or $25,000 against a slot value in the six digits. So they didn't take a lot of guys at that extreme end either.
When you look at the rest of this Cardinals class, the name Gurevich has come up a couple of times in other interviews that we've done, their third-round pick, that first baseman out of the University of San Diego. Anybody outside of the Doyle, Mitchell, Franklin first three rounds that you particularly like in the Cardinals class or maybe particularly dislike?
One I'm a big fan of, and I'm going to be interested to see how he works now that he's in the system, is Cade Crossland, their fourth-round pick. He was ranked number 207 for us, but it's a fastball 91 to 94 with pretty good carry. His changeup might be the best in the class. I was watching him show off his grip earlier, and he's like, I model it after Pedro Martinez. That's a pretty good model, I would say. But it gets tons of swing and miss. It just falls off the plate. If you watch him pitch, it's a very simple delivery. It looks like he's just kind of taking one step and firing it in there. But guys get fooled so easily by that changeup. He's worked with a knuckle curve. He's trying to develop a slider. I think that's going to be the difference maker for him, is if he can find a consistent breaking ball. But that fastball changeup is really good. And we often see guys with really good fastballs and really good changeups exceed quickly in the lower levels because guys just don't see that good of a changeup early on in their career.
Sam Dykstra is with us, reporter with MLB Pipeline and MILB. You can follow Sam Dykstra at Sam Dykstra MILB on Twitter. Sam, one of the other things that we've talked about this week, Jonathan Mayo was on the show yesterday, and we kind of talked about maybe the MLB draft starting to become just slightly more mainstream than it has been in the past. Seems, at least in my circles, that has been the case. Part of that might be that here in St. Louis, people were more interested because the Cardinals had a higher selection than they pretty much ever have in recent history. Have you noticed, as somebody who spends a lot of time covering the draft, that the interest among the casual fan is ticking up at all?
I think a little bit, yeah, for sure. And that also feeds into just the interest in prospects in general has grown significantly. I think when I started this job back in 2012, like, people would maybe know the top prospect in their system. Now when we put out rankings, people have great opinions on who is number 21 versus 22. I love it. I love that people are that interested. And, especially sometimes when the major league team's not doing as well, or if you do have a high draft pick, you're going to be following college baseball all spring, or you're going to be reading as many scouting reports as you can. I don't know exactly where this started. I think a part of this is just having more access to college baseball and the lower levels of minor league baseball. MILB TV is better than it's ever been. It used to look like it was shot on a potato. Now it's HD cameras at almost every level. I think that's a big part of it. And just having access to data, people like having opinions. They like saying, I knew this guy before he was great. Even if that's somebody like, you know, J.J. Weatherholt, who if you were following the draft last year, you'd be like, oh, I know who that guy is. Now probably more people in the St. Louis area know who he is. And then when he debuts, even more so. You want to be on that train as early as you can.
Speaking of J.J. Weatherholt, the consensus seems to be that the Cardinals are going to be put in a position where they have to find a spot for him, not only on the Major League roster, but somewhere he's in the everyday lineup next year and able to get consistent at-bats at the Major League level. First of all, do you think that's accurate? And second of all, are there any other guys you think that fans should really have circled thinking this is a guy who could make an impact as soon as next year?
Yeah, well, first on Weatherholt, I mean, I'm fascinated to see where he's going to end up because somebody was asking me the other day, you know, you've seen Jack Caglione, Nick Kurtz, Cam Smith, a lot of these guys from the first round last year make the major leagues in their first year. Could Weatherholt be that next man up? And I said no, only because he's blocked right now. I mean, you got Brendan Donovan, you got Mason Winn up the middle. Like, I don't know exactly where that room is going to be this year. Do you start to flirt with the idea of putting Donovan in the outfield next year and making room for Weatherholt at second base, where I think he would be a better defender than he would be at short? I think that's a conversation for the offseason. Is there anybody who I think could be that guy next? I mean, we've started putting in some calls because of updates and asking around, and there's still a lot of belief in that organization around Quinn Matthews. I know he's dealt with some shoulder injuries this year, was a breakout star last year, hasn't turned it around this year at Triple-A, but I think they still believe once he gets fully healthy, you know, we were talking before about Crossland and that really good changeup. Matthews has a really good changeup already that's shown in the upper levels of the minors. I think he could be a part of the rotation next year. He just needs that reset, maybe in the off season, but once he gets that shoulder right and everything's clicking again, he should be a big part of St. Louis's plans.
Yeah, it's a good point. And you figure there are going to be probably innings available in the Cardinals rotation next year, at least in the back end. And that's likely to be Michael McGreevy, potentially Quinn Matthews, especially because guys like Tekoa Roby and Tink Hentz have sort of struggled to stay healthy, especially in Hentz's case. And also, even when healthy, we haven't necessarily seen them consistently stretch out and throw the kind of innings that you would need to be a reliable every fifth day guy in the major leagues. So with those two guys in particular, with Hentz and Roby, who I think, you know, everybody feels have the stuff on their day to be major league pitchers, what's the next step? How close would you be if you were the Cardinals to just saying, you know what, we're going to give up on trying to stretch these guys out and we're going to try to make them into high-end relievers instead?
I think I would already have that conversation with Hentz, just because it's been a while since he's even gotten to 96 innings. That was 2 years ago. He's never topped 100. Roby was on that path now. I know he's on the IL, but like he at least has crossed 100 innings at some point in his career, and I think this stuff has been there more this year than it has been for Hentz. Hentz just hasn't been on the mound enough. I'd be really interested to see how that stuff is going to play. He's just had consistent health concerns. Let him throw that fastball. Let him throw that changeup enough. He doesn't need to squeeze that much more velocity out of it to be effective, even in a relief role. But I think that the clock has certainly ticked enough on Tink Hentz that I would start it here in the second half.
Sam, last one for you. Liam Doyle, what do you think is a realistic ETA for him in the major leagues?
I think it's possible we see him in the second half next year. I just think that fastball is incredibly good. It's three other above average pitches between the slider, the cutter, and the splitter. I think the splitter might be up slightly ahead of those other two, but it's explosive stuff that could help him move very quickly, and he's done it against top competition coming out of the SEC on a very competitive team with Tennessee. I mean, I don't think he's going to shrink away from the competition of the Texas League or the International League when he gets to Springfield and Memphis. I'm not saying he's going to be on that like Cam Smith or Nick Kurtz track and get up in the first half, but if he were to get called up in August or September of next year, even, it wouldn't shock me at all.
Sam, I appreciate you. We threw a lot at you in a short period of time. You handled it all beautifully. Thank you so much for making the time for us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline joining us here on Graybar Sports Open Line. You can follow him on Twitter at Sam Dykstra, MILB. When we come back, more Cardinals discussion with Benjamin Hockman of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on KMOX. Graybar Sports Open Line continues on this Thursday evening. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly. It is my pleasure to introduce now St. Louis Post-Dispatch columnist and, more importantly, Clayton Greyhound, Benjamin Hockman. Ben, how you doing?
I'm good. It's fun hearing a Greyhound and yourself replacing a Ledoux graduate like Matt Pauly.
Exactly as it should be done, right? It is certain, these are the ways of the world.
I love it.
So let's talk a little St. Louis Cardinals baseball as they get ready for the second half starting tomorrow night in Arizona. The Cardinals are 5 games above 500. They're 6.5 back in the division, 1.5 in the wild card. What's your feeling, if you were in John Mozeliak's shoes right now, about what you would want to see in the next 13 games before the deadline to convince you buy, sell, or hold? Or have you made your decision already?
Oh, great questions right off the bat. If I'm Mozeliak, I really want to see how they handle these 13 games because the opponents, three of the four series, are against guys that are under 500. So these are winnable games. If the Cardinals can really, really get in that, maybe even grab a wild card spot as opposed to being on the outside looking in, that'll confirm that St. Louis needs to make some moves to help the team. Now, okay. We can't get crazy with any moves either way, but they have to make a decision about Michael McGreevy, of course, and getting him in the rotation. Does that mean getting rid of Eric Fetty?
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of those big points of conversation. I wonder if the trade deadline is also kind of the deadline for that decision, if only because the Cardinals maybe have been holding out a little bit of hope that they could get one or two good Fetty starts in a row and still get somebody to take the money that was left on him. And if you get by the deadline, maybe then it's just time to let him go and let Greavy get into that spot. Because especially if the Cardinals are going to push toward the playoffs, it doesn't make sense to hold McGreevy out of the rotation if they think there's even a possibility he could be better than Fetty.
Exactly, and with the inconsistency of some of these other starting pitchers, it's almost as if, and it used to be like a week or two ago, it was just Michaelis and Fetty, you're doomed. 40% of your starts are doomed. But Michaelis bounced back a little bit, but then Pallante looked bad in one of his starts, so, and Liberatore struggled. So it's kind of like you have to assume that each turn through the rotation, somebody's going to be bad, and then you also got Fetty.
It's too hard to predict, you know, if those moves will happen and certainly what the moves would be. So let's just, for the purposes of this question, let's imagine that the roster is going to look pretty much the same as it does now. Maybe McGreevy comes in for Fetty, but basically working with the pieces you have right now, what are your, you know, top burning question or two going into the second half around the Cardinals for things you think could maybe make the difference on the margin of whether they do make it into one of those wild card spots or whether they just miss out?
Well, this might not be as sexy as maybe some of the other answers you'll get for this question, but I would like to see Mason Wynn and Victor Scott get on base more. I mean, who wouldn't? they need to hit more consistently, and by doing that, of course, a lot of times, especially with Victor Scott, his singles turn into doubles, if you will, because he steals bases at such a high clip. So getting those guys on base more would be key, and gosh, I mean, the bullpen, some of the guys looked a little shaky towards the end there, but, you know, they'll get some break. They're on a break right now. They'll get some rest, and hopefully they bounce back. But and then the other thing is really just, are the Cardinals going to get home runs from anybody? I mean, I think 12 is the team lead right now. This is not a slugging team. Will someone maybe emerge? Will Wilson perhaps hit more of them in the second half? That's a question to ask. And if not, can they still single you to death, if you will, the way they've done in previous games?
Is there anything, we just talked to Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline in the last segment. It's kind of the symbolic end, I think, of the MLB draft, especially with the Cardinals officially signing Liam Doyle and reportedly, according to Ryan Mitchell, agreeing to terms with him as well, the second round pick. Is there anybody or anything, whether it's, you know, kind of a theme or a style or an analytical profile that jumped out to you from how the Cardinals handled this year's draft?
Oh, I loved it. And for me, I was just hoping the Cardinals would get a left-handed starting pitcher. Now, of course, I thought that was going to be Jamie Arnold from Florida State, because surely Liam Doyle wouldn't be there at 5. And there he was. So what a great get. What a cocky son of a gun he is. And he's going to be fun to watch. He's kind of like a modern Al Horosky.
Yeah, if I know one thing about the way that Ben Hockman watches sports and what he looks for in a story, I think somebody with the color of Liam Doyle is more than welcome in your town anytime.
I can't wait. I can't wait to interview him, to describe him pitching, and hopefully for Cardinals fans it'll be after victories.
Well, we are visiting with Benjamin Hockman of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You can follow him on Twitter at Hockman. You can see all of his work at STL Today. One kind of change-up for you here, Ben, because in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking a little bit of Missouri football, including with Zach Sweet, who is the Mizzou football beat writer for the Columbia, Missouri, and a paper I know you are familiar with in your own past. So if we let me think of how I want to phrase this. The Mizzou folks made their appearances at the SEC Media Days this morning. Eli Drinkwitz has a particular way of always getting in the headlines, even nationally, after he goes to a podium like that. And he managed to do it both for some of his just general color and also for proposing college football playoff changes that are much more aligned with the Big Ten's picture of how things should go than they are with the SEC's. He even acknowledged that his answers might not make him the most popular with the commissioner. Do you think it is a positive, a negative, or a neutral for Mizzou and for the football program that Eli Drinkwitz is in the headlines as often as he is for things that are not specifically related to coaching the team?
I think it's somewhere between positive and neutral. You know, follow me on this. Reggie Jackson used to say they don't boo nobodies. you want to be a somebody. You want to be relevant. And even if yapping in July on a microphone in Atlanta, that makes you relevant. And he's playing a game. It's all a game, right? It's a business and it's a game. Oh, and it's also a sport, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, Eli's just doing what he can to make himself relevant. And again, back to what we were saying earlier about a guy like Liam Doyle, he's just fun to write about. He's fun to watch if you're a fan.
That's true. That's Kevin Wheeler and I were talking about him very briefly during Redbird Rush Hour earlier, and we were saying, you know, if he wasn't such a successful football coach, and I'm not suggesting he should change careers, he would probably make a pretty good talk radio host as well.
No question. Yeah, I'd love to listen to the Drink Hour or whatever you'd call it.
Yeah, I don't know if the Drink Hour would pay $9 million a year, but if we can scrape it together, maybe we can make the offer to him.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Ben, appreciate you so much for being with us. All the best, and we're looking forward to reading your Cardinal stories the rest of the way.
Yeah, can't wait for the trade deadline. It's going to be exciting.
Thanks a lot for being with us. Ben Hockman of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch visiting with us. Follow him on Twitter, at Hockman, and you can read all of that coverage on STL Today. We'll have some final Cardinals thoughts for this first hour when we come back. As always, you can be part of the conversation by joining our comment feed across any of our streaming destinations on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. You can also hit the open line at 314-436-7900. 314-436-7900. Get your Cardinals deadline thoughts in. Let's turn some options over. Let's think about some stuff that might have come up during the Redbird Rush Hour. Maybe it didn't. We can kind of consider that. And also, if you've got any concerns about, we didn't really get to talk about it much yesterday, but if you've got concerns about the way things are positioning and posturing between Major League Baseball and the Players Union, that's kind of bubbled up during this All-Star break, which is usually a kind of state of the game time, if you will. And things are moving in a good direction for baseball overall. I think a lot of the arrows are pointed up, especially local interest, gate revenues, those kinds of things that have always defined Major League Baseball. Those arrows are pointed in the right direction, but there are some real concerns on the horizon. One of them is the TV deal situation with ESPN and MLB mutually opting out, and that's the lion's share of MLB's marquee regular season properties now up in the air for at least the next 3 years. Rob Manfred is trying to find a destination for those, 2026, 2027, 2028. He ideally wants a three-year deal so that all those rights will come up together after the 2028 season. But the CBA is up after the 2026 season. No collective bargaining agreement beyond next season. And that's probably part of the holdup. It's probably not the primary reason, but it's probably part of the negotiations that are going on with these TV partners now, or the potential TV partners for those intervening years, because especially with how the posturing is right now between the union and the league, the possibility of a lockout in 2027, of a strike for some period of time, is looming quite large. I think a lot of folks around the industry feel that some kind of work stoppage in 2027 is likely, that baseball season will be affected in some way by labor strife. That doesn't mean it's going to be debilitating. It doesn't mean it's going to be an especially big deal. But I think there's going to be some significant strife, and there will be fireworks, and there will be friction, and there are going to be problems. And, you know, how does that affect things? You know, we're probably too far away to know which teams that would hurt the most, right? A la the Montreal Expos and the canceled World Series year. But, you know, there are going to be teams and folks who get caught on the wrong side of that situation. But for the more short term, Cardinals trade deadline is only a couple of weeks away. What are your thoughts right now? Has anything changed? Probably not. Have any of the conversations you've listened to, anything that you've read over the last couple of days, changed the thoughts from when we conducted that poll a couple of days ago and most folks were leaning sell? All of those available for conversation on our comments and through Twitter and on the listener line, 314-436-7900. We'll take a break. Graybar Sports Open Line continues in a moment.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on King of OX.
This is the fourth and final night that I have to say immediately after that. It's not Matt Pauley. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauley, who will be back tomorrow. Don't forget Redbird Rush Hour starting at 5. Matt will have Sports Open Line for you starting at 6. It'll be slightly abridged because network pregame, I should say, will begin at 7:45 before the Cardinals resume their season with a series opener against the Diamondbacks in Phoenix at 8:40 Central Time. So it'll be a late evening of Cardinals baseball, certainly into the 11 o'clock hour locally and maybe pushing midnight, although those over 3 hour games, much more of a rarity now in the pitch clock era. We have talked already about the Cardinals rotation. It's set for the weekend. Andre Pallante Friday, Sonny Gray Saturday, Miles Michaelis Sunday. That sets up for Matthew Liberatore, Eric Fetty, and then Pallante again in Colorado, and then Sonny Gray to start a week from tonight when the Cardinals return home against San Diego, the opener of a 7-game homestand going into the trade deadline. The Cardinals will play 13 games in 13 days starting tomorrow. They will be off on trade deadline day 2 weeks from today, the 31st of July. The Cardinals officially signed Liam Doyle, their first-round pick, left-handed pitcher out of Tennessee, the number 5 overall selection, reigning SEC Pitcher of the Year, to a $7.25 million bonus, the largest in club history, but nearly $900,000 under the slot value, which opens up that much money to be dispersed elsewhere without going over their allotment in the bonus pool. Ryan Mitchell, according to an interview he did in Memphis, said that he and the Cardinals agreed to a bonus of more than $1 million to get him to sign, but that is not yet official, and we don't know the exact number, so that remains to be seen. Slot value on his pick, which was number 55 overall, is $1.72 million. So if the Cardinals are at or under that, it'll give us a picture of how much money, if any, would be added to the about $880,000 they have so far saved by signing Doyle for under slot and could then be dispersed elsewhere in the bonus pool. We talked about that a little bit with Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline, who visited with us earlier in this hour, and he particularly had his eye on the Cardinals' 11th round selection, which technically does not have a slot value to it. Any picks beyond the 10th round don't, but they took Jalen Flores, shortstop out of the University of Texas, in that spot. And he speculated that Flores might be one who could receive some of that surplus money saved by signing Doyle under slot, because Flores, as an 11th round pick, would be entitled to no more than $150,000 as his maximum without the Cardinals having to count it against their bonus pool. So the Cardinals have about $14.2 million to dole out total. That's the slot values of their first 11 picks, rounds 1 through 10, plus Tanner Franklin, who was a competitive balance round B selection in between rounds 2 and 3. Those 11 guys have to be signed for $14.2 million. The 10 guys they signed from rounds 11 through 20 cannot be signed for more than $150,000 each. If you want to go over $150,000 with any of those guys, that money has to come out of the $14.2 million reserved for the guys taken in the first 10 rounds. And potentially the Cardinals would have some available to go over $150,000 to sign Flores, who, as Sam Dykstra noted, was ranked number 235 by MLB.com. The Cardinals drafted him number 330, indication of good value in terms of the pick order, good value on his talent as a selection. But it can often be an indicator, depending on guys' particular circumstances, that they're going to take a little bit of extra money in order to sign. That's one of the reasons guys sometimes slide down past their ranking. We also chatted with Ben Hochman of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about what to expect from the Cardinals in the second half. Brief little bit of Mizzou football there as well, because we're going to be talking some of that in the second hour. If you missed anything during the first hour, you can always go back and listen to it on the free Odyssey app. You can listen to us live. You can listen to Cardinals baseball live if you're in the St. Louis area. Same thing, St. Louis City Soccer. And you can get all of the KMOX Cardinals talk and sports talk beyond that available on demand in podcast form. If you're listening along on the app, you can also leave us a voice message using the TalkBack feature, and we can play it on the air. Coming up in the second hour, Dan Reardon, KMOX golf analyst, will join us to discuss the first round of the Open Championship. We have a five-way tie atop the leaderboard. World number one, Scottie Scheffler, shot a 3-under par 68. He is one stroke off the lead. The leaders are all at 4-under par. Not a lot of big names up there. In fact, I think Harris English is the only one who is anywhere near the top of the world rankings. He's number 19 in the world and tied for the lead. World number two, Rory McIlroy, playing in his home country of Northern Ireland at Royal Portrush, shot a 1-under 70. For the first round, he is three shots off the lead, a big improvement over the 8-over 79 that McIlroy shot in the first round back in 2019, his first opportunity to play at Royal Portrush as a professional, when he started with a quadruple bogey on the first hole and went all downhill from there. So we'll talk to Dan about, in particular, Scheffler and McIlroy turning in pretty good first rounds. Bryson DeChambeau turned in a very poor first round. He's well over par and off the pace and unlikely to be able to recover. Could potentially recover to make the cut, but he's going to have a tough time recovering from where he is to get back in contention to win the championship. John Rahm, a pretty solid first round. So we'll talk about all those guys, including maybe some of the guys who aren't household names up toward the top of the leaderboard who Dan thinks have staying power. Then we'll discuss a little Mizzou football as that second hour goes on, looking at the schedule, kind of game planning through how could this look for Missouri, because that season is getting underway at the end of next month. We're only about 6 weeks away now from Missouri kicking off. In fact, I think we're almost down to the minute, 6 weeks away from Missouri kicking off against Central Arkansas, is it, this year, who's the Thursday night opener. And we will talk to Zach Sweet then at the bottom of the second hour at 7:30. He is the Mizzou football beat writer for the Columbia Missourian. He was down in Atlanta for SEC Media Days that have been going on this week. Missouri had its turn this morning. Eli Drinkwitz spent some colorful minutes at the podium, and we'll discuss the quarterback situation, transfer Bo Prabula, Los Angeles Dodgers draft pick Sam Horn, who potentially would be slated as his backup, freshman Matt Zollers, all kind of in competition going into fall camp, the addition of running back Ahmad Hardy, other position groups up for grabs, all that and more. News is next. More Graybar Sports Open Line after this on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Matt Pauley is out this evening. He'll be back tomorrow when the Cardinals resume the Major League season against Arizona with the opener of a three-game series and a six-game road trip to begin the second half. Nate Gatter with you in his stead. Pleased to be joined now by KMOX golf correspondent Dan Reardon. We visited with Dan yesterday to talk about the Open Championship. We've now had 18 of the 72 holes to be played this weekend at Royal Portrush, and Dan is going to give us the lay of the land after those 18 holes. Dan, thanks so much for being with us again. Night two in a row.
Well, I'll say the same thing. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, we are very, very happy to have you. Kind of an interesting first round. The weather generally not as problematic as I think people sometimes fear with Open Championships. Pretty good scores. I think it was 30 players who wound up shooting under par, something in that neighborhood. And they have a five-way tie at the top of the leaderboard, 4-under par. Let's start there before we get to Scheffler, one shot back, McIlroy and Rahm, three shots back, DeChambeau with a disappointing showing. Let's start with the five names who are at the top, none of them household names. Who stands out to you as more likely than the others to be among the leaders all the way through the championship?
Well, you know, you mentioned it earlier in the show that these are not household names. And what struck me about this is, this is the third consecutive major. It was true at the PGA Championship. It was true at the U.S. Open. And now it's true at the Open Championship. that the first day leaderboard is not cluttered with recognizable names at the top. The reason for that, I can't give you, but they eventually sorted themselves out. And I was curious enough to go back and look at what the first round leaderboard at the Masters was, and that was star-studded. You know, I mean, that was Justin Rose, who was a runner-up, was right there at the top. Actually, Scottie Scheffler was not as high up on that list. But, the most anonymous name in the top 10, I think, on the first day at the Masters was Corey Conner. He's far from anonymous in terms of players. But when you talk about Ha-Tung Lee or you talk about Jakob Olsson and players of that sort, I mean, you really do have to search for that. And it would be natural, I think, and I've always been guilty of that, to say, okay, out of these five leaders, who's going to hold up over the four days? And then you throw away those unknowns. Well, we learned our lesson with J.J. Spahn. We can't throw them away in every case because every once in a while they stay around. So to answer your question, English has the pedigree to do this. He has the world ranking. Seven birdies will always catch your attention on any round. And then Fitzpatrick, even though he doesn't have the world ranking, what he does have is a major championship. He won at the Country Club, and he's playing in his championship, which is the Open Championship. And Fitzpatrick was the name that caught my attention this morning as he moved up the leaderboard. We knew the other guys were there. I was looking for somebody a little more legitimate, and Fitzpatrick was the name that I looked at.
So let's get to some of those big legitimate names. Scottie Scheffler, the world number one, pre-tournament favorite, of course, as he is in essentially every competition he enters. He is only one off the lead, a 3-under 68, and he did it hitting only three fairways. How afraid should the rest of the field be?
Well, there's two things I'll say in regard to that. One, Scheffler was asked that question twice. He was asked by NBC, and then he was asked in the interview room how he could play that well and miss all those fairways. And he was frankly offended at the question because he said, I drove the ball extremely well. He said, I don't know where the number comes from, but he says, he wasn't in the primary rough hardly at all.
Sure.
He was in that very short rough. So that statistic is a little bit misleading in saying that. But the other thing I'll say about Scheffler, I mentioned I looked at Fitzpatrick, and you asked me would I get up early this morning to take in this championship, guilty as charged. Scheffler played, they had a 90-minute window where they got severe weather. I mean, it was rain, it was coming down sideways, it was nasty. Scheffler played through all 90 minutes of that. And out of the players on the leaderboard, the top of the board, the only other one who played through that was Fitzpatrick, and he didn't play through as many holes as Scottie did. So I think that 3-under from Scheffler deserves a little more respect because of the circumstances where he had to hold up, and he was just hanging on. I think 7 through 13 was the stretch of holes, and he was really hanging on for dear life, getting as much out of the conditions as he possibly could. So I think he's even a little more dangerous going into tomorrow's round than you might think.
And sometimes they talk about with the American players that these greens can be a little bit of an adjustment just because they're both pretty firm and pretty slow. But he seemed like he was putting the ball really, really well, which normally if you're looking for a relative weakness in his game compared to just how strong it is everywhere else, sometimes the putter is where he's at least a mere mortal.
And some of that is he normally hits so many greens and he did in regulation that his putting totals are going to be high because you just don't make putts unless you hit it close. And Scottie has a unique talent to hit it close. I think Scottie is probably the best player, including Tiger, that I can recall, who just stiffed it so many times at various rounds over the course of his career. So, I don't know what his total number of putts are. They probably were reasonably high. But I agree with you. I thought he putted well. And when he putts well, he's really, really dangerous.
Let's talk about Rory McIlroy, the local kid who shot 9 shots better than his opening round 79 the last time the championship was at Royal Portrush in 2019. He had a couple of nervy moments off the tee early on. I imagine there were at least one or two thoughts clattering around in the back of his brain and a few others about the disaster that took place for him in that first round in 2019. But 3 shots off the lead, he hit only 2 fairways for whatever that's worth. He has to feel like he's in pretty good shape and at least breathe a sigh of relief having gotten through 18 holes unscathed.
And you mentioned the start. He did, he didn't take an 8 on his first hole.
Yeah.
He did bogey the first hole, and that sets a negative tone. But then he played really solid golf through 10, and he got to 3-under through 10. And then he got a little sloppy off the tee, and he bogeyed 3 of the next 4 holes. And he was headed the wrong direction. And then he settled down, made a couple of pars, and he birdied 17. And that birdie at 17, I think, is extremely important because it put him in a very positive frame of mind. He admitted afterwards that he realized he had bogeyed three or four holes and that something had to change because he was headed the wrong direction. And he righted the ship and got it in at one under. And if you had told him before the round you could have one under your first round, he probably would have taken it. The other thing, you know, going back to this round today, as I said, they had bad weather for part of the morning wave. And the afternoon, the weather was almost perfect. And I think McGinley said on the telecast, well, somebody's going to blow by that four under. That's not going to hold up this afternoon. Nobody did. You know, Harris English got to five under and then bogeyed to slip back to four. In really good playing conditions, nobody made a positive move at the top of the leaderboard in the afternoon. And I'll tell you one other thing, and I can't explain this at all. Out of the 31 players in red numbers, four of them would be considered very senior golfers. Mickelson at one under, Justin Leonard at one under, Lee Westwood at one under, Sergio Garcia at one under, and I'd even throw in Zach Johnson at one under, make it five. Why are guys at that age able to play a championship like this effectively on the first day? And the only thing I can suggest is they all have major championship experience. Three of them have major championships. I think once you learn to play in that game, you hold on to that for a long time.
That's a really good point and interesting, especially with some of those older guys in the back part of their careers. Let's talk about a few of the high-profile Americans who did not fare so well. I'm going to skip over some of the guys like the Patrick Reeds and Brooks Koepkas who have kind of dropped off for a while now for a variety of reasons. But I'm zeroing in on three guys. Jordan Spieth, who didn't play badly, but still two over par. Colin Morikawa, a lot of people felt good about him coming into this weekend. Just four over par for him. He's tied for 114th. And Bryson DeChambeau, it just never got going in the right direction. He shot seven over par, and he's among the bottom 15 golfers after one round.
Well, let's take those in reverse order. In the case of DeChambeau, and I have turned 100% in favor of Bryson. I love the stuff that he does on YouTube. I like the idea that he's become more mature and more of a traditionalist in his approach to the game. But you know what Bryson doesn't do? Bryson doesn't win. Hmm. Bryson gets headlines. Bryson contends. Bryson doesn't win. If you take away, and it's unfair to say that, but if you take away his win at Pinehurst, and I consider that more of a McIlroy loss than a DeChambeau win. Bryson has one, I think two wins anywhere in golf, LIV or elsewhere. He won more tournaments. He won five tournaments before he became the new Bryson than he's won since that time. He needs to figure out a way to win. And I suspect it's that as long as he is and as imaginative as he is, that he really needs to find a way to score better. If you recall, Dustin Johnson wowed the world with his length for a long, long time, and he never won championships when it mattered. And it was always because he couldn't handle the wedge. Bryson plays a wedge that is the same length as his six iron. You know, all his clubs are the same length. I don't think that standard length wedge is something that he should not consider changing because it is a scoring club. Second one, who was our second one? Spieth? Jordan rallied on the back nine. He shot 40 on the front. He shot 33 on the back. And there were reports that he was still struggling with a little discomfort in the shoulder. But I like the 33 on the back. And I frankly root for Jordan. I find him entertaining. I think you could have, you know, they have their featured groups. I think they should have just Jordan with a mic and just run that all the way through the tournament with him talking to Michael Greller. And you'd have a great telecast. So I root for him, and I'm pleased that he fought his way back with that 33. Two over is, you know, that's what we have 69 players within five shots of the lead. Jordan is within six of the lead, so I won't throw him away as well. I cannot explain Morikawa other than to say everything I read from Morikawa, and I read all of Colin's interviews, he's got something in his mind that is blocking his confidence, and he frequently talks about he's just not quite right with where he is with his game. I expected him to be one of those dark horses who contended, and you know, four over, he's not going to win this championship. But other than that, he's an exceptional iron player. He's a very accurate driver, has had good moments putting. I don't understand why he has not been more of a factor.
Well, Dan, we appreciate your time so much and your analysis. I'm sure there will be more of it as the weekend goes on. At the very least, I would imagine you're going to be visiting with Tom on Sunday morning here on KMOX, and we will look forward to all of your analysis as we always do. And I agree with you to the extent that you might moonlight as a television producer. I agree with you that Jordan Spieth mic'd up for the whole round. That's an alternate cast that I would watch.
Nate, I've enjoyed the time with you. It's been a pleasure.
Dan Reardon, KMOX golf analyst, with us here on Graybar Sports Open Line. We'll take a break, turn our attention to Mizzou football when we return on KMOX. Graybar Sports Open Line rolls on this Thursday evening. Nate Gatter in for Matt Pauly. He'll be back tomorrow when the Cardinals resume their season against Arizona. 8:40 Central Time, first pitch. Network pregame 7:45, but we'll have 2 hours and 45 minutes of sports and Cardinals talk here on KMOX before we even get to the pregame. Redbird Rush Hour at 5. Graybar Sports Open Line tomorrow at 6. Network pregame at 7:45. Matt Pauly will be with you for all of it. Kevin Wheeler and Bernie Miklas also along for Redbird Rush Hour tomorrow at 5. By the way, we are with you until 8 o'clock, Sports Open Line this evening, and then Jen Cease will be in with City Spotlight from 8 to 9, so you can get your fill of St. Louis City conversation. None of that tonight in Sports Open Line, but we did talk about it the last couple of evenings with City coming off that 2-1 win over Portland, and also the official signing of Fadlu Fall, new center back, young 21-year-old from Senegal by way of the Norwegian League. A lot of excitement around him. Potentially some more additions as well to come for City that have been reported but are not yet official. Mizzou football conversation. We were planning to take some phone calls during this segment. You can always be part of the conversation by commenting on our streams on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, tweeting us at KMOX Sports. And the phone number is 314-436-7900. Not enough time because we're going to be visiting with Zach Sweet, Mizzou football beat writer for the Columbia Missourian, in just about 6 minutes. But on the back end of the show, after that segment, we're going to have one more segment at the very end. Call it 7:45, 7:50 or so. And we will take calls during that time, whether you want to talk Cardinals, Mizzou football, Open Championship, all the stuff we've talked about tonight, or anything else that might be on your mind. We'll take whatever is going down. Mizzou football conversation. The Tigers had their SEC Media Days appearances this morning. Eli Drinkwitz, the headliner, of course, the head coach at Missouri. And we will talk about all of that with Zach Sweet. Missouri will be opening its season in just under 6 weeks now. It'll be 5 weeks, 6 days, and 23 hours. A 6:30 kickoff on August the 28th. That's a Thursday night against Central Arkansas. They will open the season with six straight home games, plus a bye mixed in on the first Saturday in October. Central Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana, South Carolina, Massachusetts, Alabama. And they will not go on the road for the first time until Auburn at Jordan-Hare Stadium on October the 18th. Think about that. 6 weeks until the season opens, still 3 full months from now. July 18th is tomorrow. 3 months from tomorrow will be Missouri's first road game of the entire season. They'll play Vanderbilt on the road the following week, then a bye, then Texas A&M and Mississippi State at home, Oklahoma and Arkansas on the road to finish. We're going to ask Zach about this, and I'll take your calls on it. Vegas has Missouri's win total over-under at 7.5. I don't think even 8 wins, let alone 7, would make this fan base very happy with where expectations have gone. And Vegas, in fact, has the loaded value on the up end of the 7.5, meaning that they think 7 is more likely than 8. So to the extent that Vegas is making a choice, they're saying 7-5 is Missouri's most likely record. I'm not sure I see that. Right, Central Arkansas win, Kansas, obviously rivalry game, but you have to think of that as a game that Missouri expects to win with where the program is right now. Same story, Louisiana, not straightforward. Let's skip over some of the games that I think are more toss-ups. Let's call Massachusetts probably a win. That's 4. Let's say loss to Alabama at home. There's 1 loss. Let's say you lose to Texas A&M. The way I like to think of it is kind of games in buckets. So let's say Alabama and Texas A&M you lose. Although A&M is at home, I don't think that's an unwinnable game. Then South Carolina at home, Auburn, Vanderbilt on the road, Oklahoma on the road. What I would do is put those 4 games in a bucket and say you're probably losing two of them. I don't know which two, but I think you're likely to beat Mississippi State, Arkansas, UMass, Louisiana, Kansas, and Central Arkansas. You're likely to lose to Alabama, and maybe you put Texas A&M in that category too, although it is at home, so maybe that gets you a little bit extra. And then you have Auburn, Vanderbilt, Oklahoma on the road, South Carolina at home. Probably losing a couple of those games, in my mind. Probably best case scenario would be 11-1 if everything went perfect. But to me, 8-4 probably feels the most realistic, that you take losses against Alabama and A&M, and then you put those other four games in a bucket. South Carolina at home, Auburn, Vanderbilt, Oklahoma on the road. And you say 2-2 in those games, and that gets you to 8-4 overall. That feels probably about right to me. I think probably 9 wins would be the realistic best case scenario, and 11-1 would be the absolute everything goes perfectly season, and you find your way probably into the playoff, almost certainly into the playoff. Would you be happy with 8-4? Or do you think I'm totally wrong and 7 or 8 wins is actually not the realistic spot and they should be at 9 wins or more minimum? We'll talk about that with Zach Sweet, and we'll take your calls later on in the show as well as we get into our final half hour of Graybar Sports Open Line. More Mizzou football conversation after this. Mizzou football conversation continues. Nate Gatter with you in for Matt Pauly, Graybar Sports Open Line this evening. And we are joined by Zach Sweet, Missouri football beat writer for the Columbia Missourian. You can follow him on Twitter at @ByZachSweet. That's @ByZachSweet on Twitter. Zach, how you doing?
I'm doing good, man. How are you doing, Nate?
I am doing all right. SEC Media Days this morning. Eli Drinkwitz always entertaining at the podium. What did you take away the most from his comments?
Man, Drink is always a treat when he goes up to that podium. I mean, outside of his comedy to start off, I really took away the most his thoughts on the SEC expanding its schedule from 8 to 9 games, and also the expansion of the college football playoff. Of course, I'm sure everyone now on Twitter has seen that quote going around about the 30-team expansion, which is obviously ridiculous. But I thought that comment was definitely the most interesting thing he said.
How do you think he feels in that sort of ongoing debate? Is there a divide, do you think, among SEC coaches on playing an 8-game schedule in the conference as opposed to 9?
It's really tough to tell, honestly, because all the SEC coaches, I mean, not all the SEC coaches are as open as Drink is, as we Missouri faithful know. Drink is very open with everything he says, and he's not afraid to hold back, and he wants his voice heard. But not all the SEC coaches are like that. So I think there's definitely a divide, but it's hard to know who stands where. A lot of the coaches, so I was up there in Atlanta the last 2 days. A lot of the coaches continued to talk about backing the SEC, and obviously Sankey and this whole thing is pretty set on that 12-team playoff. That 12-team playoff right now, and not wanting to expand to a 9th conference game. And the Big Ten and SEC seem to be at a bit of a standstill. So Drink's comments were certainly eye-opening, though.
So let's go through some of these position situations for Missouri. Let's start at quarterback, obviously the most important position on the field. Assuming that Sam Horn passes on this opportunity to sign with the Dodgers, who drafted him as a pitcher in the 18th round, it's going to be this quarterback room of the transfer Bo Prabula, who Missouri paid a lot of money to get to Columbia, Sam Horn, who has, we think, still a high ceiling as a passer, but has really never been healthy enough to get his opportunity, and then the freshman Matt Zollers, who people are excited about, but obviously he's in his first campaign in college. Do you feel at this stage it's safe to label Prabula essentially the presumed starter unless he loses the job in camp, or do you think Eli Drinkwitz and the Missouri Brain Trust would rather treat it as an open job for the time being and force somebody to go win it?
Now, that's a great question. And I am a strong believer that this is a very open competition right now. I think that both quarterbacks have a legitimate chance at being the starter on day one. I think someone's going to go and earn it in fall camp. And between Horn and Prabula, Well, we know what both are capable of, and both have similar skill sets. Both are very mobile. They're both going to get you outside the pocket. They're going to make plays with their feet. But we don't really know the full potential of either of them. Purdue has only thrown 50 balls off college, and Horn, of course, as you mentioned, he's recovering from Tommy John surgery, so we don't really know what the arm looks like. But Eli Drinkwitz, what I will say, has been adamant that this is very much an open competition right now, and someone's going to go win it in camp.
What's probably not an open competition is the running back position, where Ahmad Hardy was one of the most sought-after transfers, certainly at running back and maybe on the offensive side of the ball, period, around the country, coming in from Louisiana Monroe. I've seen different sources peg him as preseason, potentially as high as first-team preseason All-SEC, certainly in that preseason All-SEC mix. How does that running back room look behind him? And maybe more importantly, just how high are the expectations locally around what Hardy might be able to do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I actually wrote an article about this about two or three weeks ago, but Ahmad Hardy fits perfectly for what Mizzou does schematically with outside zone and attacking the edge and getting upfield. And the way Hardy cuts and everything he did last year at ULM looks really, really impressive. So Hardy is definitely going to be your workhorse. But I'd expect to see a lot of Jamal Roberts on third downs and passing situations, because he is an incredible blocker. And we saw that last year. He picked up some major blocks late in games. And ultimately, I think Roberts is the better blocking back of the two. Of course, Hardy's going to get the bulk of the carries, but definitely expect to see Roberts. And then Drinkwitz has been praising Marquise Davis, who's a freshman he got from Kentucky. He's also has a ton of potential and a ton of room to develop as a player. And I think learning behind Roberts is blocking, and of course Hardy's upfield cutting and lateral movements is going to be key for his development. So I like that you brought up what's going on behind Hardy, because everyone's talking about Hardy, of course.
Zach Sweet is with us, the Mizzou football beat writer for the Columbia, Missouri, and you can follow him on Twitter @ByZachSweet. So let's go to some other position groups then. Are there any where you think things are still just truly up for grabs? Where are the biggest question marks position group-wise in this Missouri roster right now?
So I actually asked Drink about this today, because I mean, he said it himself. He said it's the biggest question mark. I had it written down that it was the biggest question mark. But the offensive line, you lose three starters in the SEC, and it's a huge uncertainty. So Connor Tolleson, who we talked to at SEC Media Days today, did confirm that he'll be back by week one, which is a massive development, because they really need his leadership and experience losing three guys. And at left guard, it's definitely going to be Caden Green. He's getting looked at as a national, as a NFL draft pick, first round draft pick, potentially, if he can take a leap this year. But he's only given up one sack all of college. So Caden Green is going to be your guy there. But the other three spots is where it gets interesting. Drinkwitz has talked a lot about the leadership that Dominic Giudice has brought in. Dominic Giudice, of course, a Michigan transfer. Drinkwitz actually confirmed to me today that Giudice is going to be playing right guard. He moved him to right guard at the end of spring ball, and he really liked what he saw there. So Giudice is looking like the right guard. Deegan Trost, the grad transfer from Wake Forest, he's going to slot in at right tackle in all likelihood. And then Drinkwitz talked about how the left tackle is up in there. They went out and got a transfer, Johnny Williams from West Virginia, who's a redshirt sophomore. He's got a ton of potential. Javen Richardson, who's a JUCO transfer, redshirt junior, he could slot in there. Logan Reichert has been with the program for a number of years. Drinkwitz also talked about the development of Curtis Piegler, who's a redshirt junior, and Jalen Early as well. So there's no really telling what that left tackle spot is going to look like. But in general, the line is definitely going to look different this year, and I think it's certainly the biggest question mark. I mean, Hardy's only as good as that line.
All right, Zach, you know where this interview was ultimately going to culminate. It's that time of year where we put people on the spot, and I suppose the media polling in the preseason already gave you a warm-up on this, so at least you're not having to come into it cold. But we were going through the schedule in the segment before this. We were looking at the Vegas line, which has Mizzou over-under at 7.5 wins total for the year, with a higher likelihood on the low end than on the high end. So I suppose they're picking 7-5 as the most likely record out in the desert. What do you have your eye on on, let's say, first of all, what do you think is the minimum number of wins that the fan base could live with without feeling like this was a disappointing step back? And then where do you think they're most likely to end up?
I mean, that's a difficult question, but certainly I think that the floor for this team, given the schedule, I'm sure you guys were just talking about it, but they open with six straight home games. And then the road games are at Auburn, at Vandy, at Oklahoma, at Arkansas. You're not going to the likes of Bama, Georgia, Texas. I really think that this fan base is expecting another double-digit win season, which to me personally seems a bit high. I'm not going to lie. I think that this team likely slots in around 8 or 9 wins right now. There's a ton of uncertainty, but that schedule, man, it's really light compared to some of the other SEC gauntlets that are played this year.
It's a really good point. A lot of unknowns still to come. Obviously, a lot will center on Bo Prabula, as you mentioned, the offensive line. We didn't even talk about the defense, so that'll be for a future visit. Zach, we appreciate your time, and we look forward to you helping to answer some of those questions between now and Missouri's opener 6 weeks from tonight.
Yeah, man, I'm happy to come back on whenever. Just let me know.
Zach Sweet, Mizzou football beat writer for the Columbia, Missouri, and you can follow him on Twitter at @ByZachSweet. We'll take a break. If you've got calls on Mizzou football, on the Cardinals, on anything else you want to talk about, the number is 314-436-7900. You can also hit the comments section wherever you're watching the stream, if you are, across our streaming options on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. You can tweet us at KMOX Sports. And I think, especially if we don't get a lot of you chiming in wanting to talk about anything else in particular, I think I saw Jen Cease might already be out there in the newsroom and could give us a little sneak peek as to what might be coming on City Spotlight this evening from 8 to 9 p.m. Wouldn't that be a good time? Graybar Sports Open Line. One more break. We'll wrap up the show coming up next on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Mizzou football, how many wins? Vegas says 7.5 is the over-under. Zach Sweet, who we just talked to, you can go back and hear that in podcast form when it's up and available on the free Odyssey app in just a few minutes. He says 8 or 9. I think if you pin me down, I think I'd say 8 and 4 in the regular season right now, and then you hope for a winnable bowl game, still get 9 wins. I don't think Mizzou fans would be very, very happy with that. But SEC Media Day is today. Fall camp cranking up. It's really the unofficial start of football season in the SEC. It's the official start of football season this week across the NFL with training camps getting underway. Good to have the feel of football in the air, even if temperatures are still routinely in the 90 degrees. And good to visit with Zach. And, you know, we try to, when the opportunity presents itself, to highlight folks who are in Mizzou's terrific student media programs. We try to do that. And there's a certain, a certain symbolism. That's not really the word that I'm looking for. A certain repetition in the fact that we had Ben Hochman, a Mizzou journalism alum, in the first hour, now holding things down here with the Post-Dispatch, and then Zach Sweet, who would have designs of doing something very similar then during the second hour. Don't forget, Matt Pauley will be back tomorrow for Redbird Rush Hour at 5 with Kevin and Bernie, then Graybar Sports Open Line and Network Pregame starting at 7:45 before the Cardinals resume their season. Second half gets underway against Arizona, 8:40 local first pitch for the Cardinals in Phoenix. All right, all of that is out of the way, and that means we get to talk now to Jen Cease about the City Spotlight that's coming up this evening. Well, actually, hold on. We got one man on the line who would like to chat. So, oh no, Jen's mic is off again. Who is on the line? Richard is with us. Richard, you're on KMOX.
Yes, I'd like to know if you think the Cardinals could get either Ben Brown or Mitch Keller for Nolan Gorman.
I think it's going to be a tall task to get any controllable starting pitcher for somebody with the inconsistency of Nolan Gorman, especially Mitch Keller. We touched on his name very briefly during Redbird Rush Hour. And, you know, on top of that, you're dealing with the fact that I don't know that you're getting Mitch Keller for a Nolan Gorman level player anyway. Mitch Keller is within the division, and I think that's a big challenge. I mean, that's a guy, a 3.48 ERA, even though he has the 3-10 record. It's fun to watch the Keller and Skeens records that are so incongruent with their ERAs how that has gone this season. But Keller, in particular, I think is going to be a challenge for the Cardinals compared to some other options on the starting pitching market because of his years of control and because of the fact that the trade would be within the division, and the Pirates probably do not love the idea of Mitch Keller pitching against them 2, 3, 4 times a year for the foreseeable future. And Nolan Gorman, I think, is a guy the Cardinals probably would rather not trade right now. I think if Nolan Gorman's going to be traded, that's more likely to be part of an offseason deal when they can really kind of think through it. Same story, I think, with Jordan Walker, that those are guys they're just unlikely to trade in the short term with a deadline deal just because of the ceiling that still exists for both of those guys. And we're seeing it more with Gorman, who, you know, since late May has been a really, really good hitter for the Cardinals and has gotten things moving in the right direction. So I would be surprised. I don't think a Gorman for Keller deal would be possible, but I would be surprised in general if Gorman is on the move during these next couple of weeks. It would be a little less shocking maybe if it happened in the regular season, just because there's the logjam element to keep in mind. I don't think almost anybody is untouchable on the Cardinals roster, not because they're not good players, but just because the Cardinals have a lot of guys for only so many spots, and they need to clear some of those out because you just don't need guys to be sitting on the bench or down at AAA. They're not giving you any value. And so, you know, that's why we've talked about somebody like Lars Nootbaar being a candidate, even though the Cardinals like him plenty and he's a perfectly good player. Nolan Gorman could be one of those candidates. Jordan Walker, maybe, though you're wary of trading a still young player who's probably close to the bottom that his value could possibly be. Even could Mason Winn potentially be a candidate to be traded in the offseason if Heim Bloom says, you know what, I like J.J. Weatherhold at shortstop. I don't want to move him to second base. I don't want to move him to center field. I want him to play short, and Mason Winn was not my guy, and I can go out and get something good for him. I don't think that's out of the question. You know, in general, this transition from John Mozeliak to Heim Bloom, combined with the type of roster the Cardinals have, with a lot of good players and not a lot of great ones, is going to lead me to think that probably nobody is off the table, that anybody would be a possibility for the Cardinals. All right, now, Jen Cease is with us. Thank you for the call, Richard. We do appreciate you. I don't want to make it seem like you were holding up the show, but Jen Cease is ultimately the show, and so we have to spend these last 6 minutes on Jen before City Spotlight. Luckily, even though you got shorted a couple of minutes with her there, you're going to get her for a whole nother hour. Let's start there. What's on the docket? What's coming up on City Spotlight tonight?
First of all, I wanted to be sure I could get on if I wasn't a Mizzou graduate. Does Lindenwood's allowed here, right?
Yes, there are rules.
Yeah, we are, Daniel.
Only because Daniel Hinkamp is producing this evening, we do allow one Lindenwood guest per show, but that is the maximum.
It'll be all right. So, yeah, a lot going on. First of all, I miss you as my City Spotlight co-host. We
don't
had a lot of fun. We could do a whole segment just giving each other a bunch of, you know, nonsense.
Yes, I think we have done it. I think if we got Steve Moore on the phone, our boss, I think he would say that we've done many segments that way already.
Yes, we did. We sure did. But sometimes you can't get guests. But this hour, we do have guests. We're going to start off and talk City 2. Their win, 9 wins straight, even though John Hackworth would tell you he doesn't like to use the word streak. They're on a streak and really good. We're going to talk with Charlie Bilyeu. He's a University City student journalist, so he'll join us first. And then Dale Schilly, of course, as always, to talk about the Portland win, game analyst on Y98, City Academy director. And I believe now City 2
interim
assistant.
City 2 assistant, so you can talk about that too.
He's
my
so
goodness,
busy.
Is he wearing a lot of hats or what?
He really is. And then another person who wears a hat typically is Tom Timmerman.
He's
going to join at the bottom of the hour to talk, you know, a little bit more about City transfer window. I saw him having a little side conversation with Lutz on Tuesday. Maybe he's got some information for us there he can share. He's a beat writer. He should have good info. And then we'll wrap it up with the City player profile that we have every Y98 pregame with Haziel Orozco. What a great young man.
Yes, and just announced today that he's, or reported today,
reported,
I guess, by Tom Bogert.
I've been checking.
It wasn't announced and made official, but reported by Tom Bogert on Twitter today that
Orozco
officially has a first-team contract, which would not be a big surprise considering that interim manager David Critchley has talked glowingly about him.
Yeah, and I've got actually a quote from him just kind of talking from on Tuesday. And I think he said it again today at the press conference that, you know, he's not involved in those, but he has a good recommendation for Hazi, as they call him. So what a great young man. Great story of him coming from Real Salt Lake. And that was his first start and first appearance back at his home club. So great story.
Yeah, really, really fun and enjoyable to be to have you here and to get to be part of this a little bit again. We had Tom Timmerman on Tuesday.
Oh, Timmerman's been busy on KMOX.
Yes, he has been busy. And we were talking about the one so far confirmed transfer for St. Louis City recently. There have been, again, a couple of other reports, namely from Tom Bogert, on a couple of other names potentially coming in from Minnesota. But the confirmed name is Falu Fall, who strikes me as, since City kicked off, if we started time in March of 2023 or February of 2023, I guess it technically was, when the first team began play. So we didn't count the Berkeys and Klauses and Leuvens, who all signed before the first season began. I think he's probably the highest profile transfer they've had since then. Certainly the most expensive transfer they've had since then. We don't know the exact figure. Tom speculated probably $3 to $3.5 million.
I saw that floating around somewhere.
And a guy who is really young and really projectable. And so he feels like a different type of player than City have had so far, which is a guy who, if he has a couple of good years here and develops, they could be then sailing back to Europe for double, triple, quadruple what they paid.
Yeah, and I really like, too, getting a player that, I know he's played in Norway, but, you know, from somewhere, different part of the world, different kind of background, different kind of skill set. I got a little once bitten, twice shy from Jean Da Silva. We haven't seen a lot come from that move. I was pretty excited about seeing more speed. Different position, I know, but I understand a Falu to be, Falu, I think is how you say it, right? Falu Fall to be something that I don't know that he can make a really big immediate impact. We've seen it happen before, but not sure how fast he'd get in and make an impact on that back line. But definitely got strengths on the being a left footer. Doesn't hurt. I think he's 6'4".
Yeah, he's a big guy. He's a young guy. His market value has just exploded. I mean, this is a guy who Reims in France were almost giving away just a year ago, and he's completely transformed his entire early career with 1 year in the Norwegian League. And now here he comes to St. Louis with a chance to do even more. Jen, we appreciate you so much. We're looking forward to tuning in to City Spotlight this evening. Have a lot of fun.
I'll miss you, Gatter.
Yes, I will miss the show as well. Thank you so much to all of our other guests as well. Sam Dykstra from MLB Pipeline talked MLB Draft. Ben Hockman from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch talking Cardinals. Dan Reardon, KMOX Golf Analyst. We discussed the first round of the Open Championship going into the second round, which will tee off in, about 5 hours, a little less than that now. Mizzou football. Also, Zach Sweet, who joined us to discuss the Tigers, and obviously Jen Cease here in studio. She doesn't really count because she had to be here to host the show next hour, but we'll count her anyway. If you missed any of the show, you can go back and hear it in podcast form on the free Odyssey app. You can also listen to Gen City Spotlight live coming up in the next hour there on the Odyssey app. If you're in the St. Louis area, you can hear Cardinals baseball for free and everything else that we do here on KMOX. Matt Pauly will be back tomorrow for Redbird Rush Hour starting at 5, Graybar Sports Open Line at 6, Cardinals Network pregame 7:45, and the resumption of the second half of the season, the Cardinals and the Diamondbacks 8:40 Central Time. For producer Daniel Hinkamp, Nate Gatter saying so long. Thanks so much for being with me tonight and this entire week filling in for Matt. Had a lot of fun. Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.